Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 27th of July. I began last week's podcast by talking about how bland and uniform ordinary time was, like the lower stretches of a big river meandering across a flat, flat landscape. It was almost dull. Soon afterwards, I got an email, a friendly email from a listener who said that the wide uneventfulness was just what she loved about ordinary time, compared with the Sturm und Drang of the high seasons, Advent, Christmas, Lent and Easter, all the way up to Corpus Christi, big events, big ideas, always something new and deep to absorb. Whereas ordinary time just flows. It was a friendly email, and she finished it by saying basically let's agree to disagree, except that once I thought about it, I didn't disagree, I saw her point. So it ended up as a case of I am right and so are you. The thing is, our religious lives are directed to getting to know God, getting to live with God, to think along with God. If instead of thinking about a relationship with God in those terms, you think about it with other people, you'll see that a process like this is naturally a slow thing to be doing. When I think of someone close to me, whether a friend or a relation, father, mother, brother or sister, whoever, the first thing to say about them is that they have been there for a long time. The facts I know about them now weren't presented to me in the beginning as an itemized list to be learned all at once, the way you might do it at school. When and where born and to whom, where educated, whether married, and if so, to whom, any children, the whole who's who entry. That is not how life works. Even if I'm thinking about someone I only met a year or two ago, we didn't begin our acquaintance exchanging a lot of facts. We met first, just met, that's all. And gradually, by an odd accident now and then, here and there a fact emerged and we started to know more things about each other than we once did. To give you an example, I know now certain things about the woman called Angel who most mornings is the first one in at the cafe I go to. I know she is Indian, not Carib, because I asked. I know she is called Angel because she was born in St. Peter's Square during a public appearance by Pope Pius XII. Not a lot of people can say that. When she was 8, she fell out of a window 3 floors up, and she was very much broken, and it was by a miracle that she survived at all. She missed years of school, and now we all know why she waddles when she walks. Indeed, she could count as disabled, but she works hard because she detests idleness. She reads the Bible daily, she goes to Mass at least once a week. And I could go on and on, except that, first, none of this detail is important to the point I'm trying to get at here, and second, no accumulation of facts could give any sense of the angelness of Angel. The facts are not the person. They never are. Indeed, it sometimes seems that the more facts you are told about someone, the further away the actual person becomes. Why I have brought this up at all is not those particular angel facts, but how we came to know them. Nobody gave us a list to read and learn. We just spent time seeing each other most days, and the slow process of getting to know each other took years. Months might pass between the appearance of one fact and the next one, and it is still going on. I think this is what my podcast correspondent was telling me about ordinary time. Ordinary time is a long, slow river. It carries a load of silt the way old rivers do, and now and then it drops a little of it the way old rivers do, and that slow accumulation is how we get river islands and estuaries and deltas. As it is with people, and as it is with rivers in flat landscapes, so it is with God. An ordinary time spirituality would be one that didn't directly study God or study scripture, or indeed study at all. It would just place itself in the muddy waters of the divine, and then let God do the accumulating when and how he chooses. As the liturgy follows its undramatic cycle through the years, year after year, one year, for no reason that we can see, but God can, some phrase in it speaks to us. It's not much. A river doesn't drop a whole load of silt all at once, but it adds to what there was already. Our relationship with God works like a relationship with friends or with lovers or with people one meets in cafes. It is slow and sedimentary, and if you let it flow, it gets more substantial and solid with time. So the ordinary time method, if you want to call it that, amounts to this. Read regularly and listen regularly. Don't expect the words to speak to you every time. In fact, don't expect, full stop. When the words want to say something, or God tells them to, you will be ready because you are so soaked in them that you are ready to hear them and understand what they are telling you. I had a minor example of this the other night. I woke up at 4 a.m. or some inhuman time like that, and the more I tried not to think so as to get back to sleep, the more my mind did think. It was racing. In the end, I stretched out for my phone, opened Universalis at the Office of Readings, and pressed the play button. I lay back and let myself listen. I heard some psalms, the first half of the first reading, then the second reading starting somewhere in the middle, and then I woke up and it was light. I looked at the screen and saw the passage I'm about to read you. It fitted my state of life so well that I copied and pasted it at once so that I could mention it in this podcast. Here it is. We should like you to realize, brothers, that the things we had to undergo were more of a burden than we could carry, so that we despaired of coming through alive. Yes, we were carrying our own death warrant with us, and it has taught us not to rely on ourselves, but only on God, who raises the dead to life. And he saved us from dying, as he will save us again. This comes from the beginning of the second letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians. It was exactly what someone overburdened with responsibilities ought to be hearing, especially at 4 in the morning. And it came not by intention, not by choice, not by looking to see what passage speaks most to my state of mind at this present moment, just by happening to be awake at the wrong time on this particular day. I say happening to be awake, but happening to be is not quite a safe assumption to make where God is concerned. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I think the spirituality of ordinary time, the way my correspondent made me see it, is this. Soak yourself. Soak yourself in the river and let the silt build up. It works in relationships with human beings, and it works with God. Someone else wrote to me about Universalis a while ago, but I can't find the email just now. I remember it, though, because he did exactly what I've just described. He spent 10 years listening to the Liturgy of the Hours, immersing himself in it, before he felt called to receive baptism, which, indeed, he did. This ordinary time philosophy means that we shouldn't expect fireworks every week, but we should immerse ourselves in everything that is being given us. The more you don't expect it to bring big revelations, the easier it is to soak, without expectations, ready for God to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. This week's first readings at Mass have a lot of what you might call the bits of scripture everybody should remember. We have the golden calf. We have Moses talking face to face with the Lord as a man does with his friend, and his face glows afterwards and he doesn't know it. On Friday there is a boring reading from Leviticus about the religious calendar and how to follow it, except that that isn't boring at all because the reading is really about the universal instinct to sanctify life by sanctifying time. Anyone who has a birthday knows that. And Saturday's reading from Leviticus is very boring, except it isn't, because it is about how once every 50 years, that is, after a week of weeks of years, the land rests and even debtors are forgiven. A sound piece of economics. Judaism is a practical religion, and to be practical you need rules, and that is why these rules have charm. There are many saints this week. They come from all times and all parts of the world. They are all of them memorials at most, which means that although we celebrate them, they do not disturb the steady rhythm of our readings. It is the long, slow river again. Saints Martha, Mary, and Lazarus are the most noticeable for me on Tuesday the 29th. They are the oldest saints this week, but also the newest celebration, because until the scholarly consensus had settled firmly on Mary Magdalene not being Mary of Bethany, nobody was sure quite who should be celebrated this Tuesday, and it was the memorial of St. Martha alone. In the New Testament, the family at Bethany are the only family we see from the inside, as it were. About the Holy Family itself, we know it exists, but that's about all. When Mel Gibson made The Passion of the Christ, it seemed right to him to include a domestic family scene of the Holy Family with Joseph in it, but it feels embarrassingly dutiful and half-baked. The Gospels themselves are too centred on Jesus to want to say anything about how his family worked. There were more important things to talk about, and anyway, none of the evangelists knew. But in two short sketches, the family of Martha, Mary, and Lazarus comes alive. When I was young, I was Mary, at least in the sense that I used to be fascinated by what fascinated me and completely forget that anything else needed doing. I didn't have Jesus to sit at the feet of, but I did have books. I can still visualize one scene vividly. We are all setting out to go somewhere, and I've been sent upstairs to change. I am sitting on the side of the bed. I have taken one shoe off and undone the laces of the other. But then I saw a book. Just one page, I promised myself, just one page, that's all. But here I am sitting, and I simply don't know how much time has passed. It might have been an instant, but experience tells me that it may very well have been a lot more than an instant. There's a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach that any moment now, angry voices will be calling up to me, Martin, aren't you ready yet? Perhaps if I drop everything and rush to get changed now, too much time won't have passed and I won't be late and no one will shout at me. But perhaps it's too late for that already. Let me just read this next page. In the Gospel, we are in the house at Bethany. Mary has remembered to put the pot on the stove all right, but then she got talking to Jesus and now the pot is boiling over. Martha has to get it. You can be sure that this isn't the first time that this has happened, because it is a rule that whatever happens once in a family happens 100 times. This time it happened to be Jesus that made Mary forget everything else, but at other times it could have been practically anything. This is not the first time that Martha has complained, just as it wasn't the first time that my family complained. At first sight, Jesus' reply to her is unhelpful. Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion which will not be taken away from her. Hearing it makes you feel Martha is being hard done by. You have to remind yourself that those are not the only words that Jesus will have spoken to the sisters. This saying may sound unhelpful when we hear it in the story, but it has been used by the Church to justify the existence and validity of the contemplative life which overflows with spiritual riches which, one way or another, do good to all of us. Yes, of course it is necessary that some people should do like Martha, and not just contemplate like Mary, but a life of contemplation is not in itself a waste of time. There is more to this family than the busy one and the dreamy one who forgets everything when she listens to Jesus. I noticed the other day that there are two possible gospel readings for Tuesday. The other one is about the raising of Lazarus. Jesus says to one of Lazarus's sisters, "Your brother will rise again," and she replies, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Which of the sisters says this? It is Martha, not Mary. I see Martha as the kind of compact, practical woman who stands squarely before you with the same amount of weight on each foot and looks you in the eye. Martha is the kind of woman who, when 12 chickens need preparing for market, goes and wrings the necks of 12 chickens. What needs doing gets done. Duties are duties. It is Martha who answers Jesus, because she may not be all mystical like her sister, but just as duties are duties, so equally facts are facts. What is true is true. My brother will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. She knows this as unemotionally, as straightforwardly, as she knows the market price of chickens. I am not Mary so much nowadays. I am anxious and troubled about many things, just like St. Martha. But Martha, solid Martha, standing foursquare facing Jesus with her fists on her hips, saying, "If you had been here, he would not have died," she is a saint. At a friend's wedding many years ago now, the priest who blessed the union was a friar who hated everybody. Most particularly, he hated the Pope. I understood quickly that this is politics. You start with knowing that Pope John Paul II is a bad thing, and after that, any reason for hating him will do. The reason I remembered particularly was this: he has made too many saints. Well, popes don't make saints. God makes saints. All the church does is recognize them. But the friar has something to complain about, because recent popes have been making it clear with their canonizations that sanctity can be found anywhere, in all countries, in all cultures, in all ages, and in all conditions of life. I found myself thinking about this week, because the saints are so widely scattered around the world. Denmark, Norway, and Sweden do not celebrate St. Martha and the others on Tuesday along with the rest of us. They have to move them because Tuesday is the feast day of St. Olaf Haraldsson, martyr and king of Norway. He spent his youth as a Viking raiding England and incidentally becoming interested in Christianity. When he fought his way to the top and declared himself king of Norway in 1015 at the age of 20, it was as a Christian king. It's worth pausing here and noting that to be a saint it isn't necessary to be wet. Warriors can be good warriors, and good warriors can be saints. Olaf established Christianity in Norway and brought bishops and priests from England and demolished many pagan temples, but the Norwegian aristocracy hated having a king telling them what to do. They rebelled and invited King Canute, king of England and Denmark, to come and be their king instead. Olaf was driven into exile in Russia in 1028, and when he tried to return, there was a great battle on the 29th of July 1030, and he fell in battle on that day. He was acclaimed as a saint soon after his death, and he is now the patron saint of Norway, revered by Catholics and Protestants alike. I've just realized that Olaf's millennium comes in 5 years' time, and I wonder how they'll celebrate it. Most of us don't think of India as a Christian country, but in fact there have been Christians in India since apostolic times, and there are four times as many Catholics in India as there are in England. They should be sending missionaries to us. This week there are two Indian saints. If the 27th were not a Sunday, Goa would be celebrating Blessed Rudolf Acquaviva and his companions. They were Jesuit missionaries from Goa to the court of the Mughal Emperor Akbar the Great in 1579. They were well received at court, but with little apparent effect, and on a later mission to Hindu regions south of Goa, they were attacked and killed by the local villagers, probably because the coming of Christianity would destroy the livelihood of the Hindu priests. At almost the other end of history is Saint Alphonsa Muttathupadathu, who was born in 1910. She was brought up in a Christian household, but came under the power of an aunt who insisted on arranging a suitable marriage for the child, when all she wanted was to be a Carmelite and spend her life praying. Finally, she used the only means of escape she had left. She thrust her foot into the fire so that, disfigured, she would no longer be a marketable commodity. She entered the Carmelite college at the age of 17 and became a nun at 25. She died young, at the age of 36, after many illnesses, leaving behind a convent convinced of her sanctity. Probably to the annoyance of that friar I met, John Paul II did indeed proclaim her blessed, on a visit to India in 1986, and Pope Benedict XVI completed the process by canonizing her in 2008. For another remote part of the world, you could pick Abyssinia, which covers what is now Ethiopia and Eritrea. Blessed Justin de Jacobis was born in Italy in 1800 and went to Abyssinia as a missionary. This was an immensely difficult task, and it wasn't a huge success. But all the same, Justin was exactly the right type of missionary, because he loved the local culture and built on its traditions instead of trying to sweep them all away. That is always the way to do it, as much so today as it was then. Another listener to the podcast wrote to me a while ago. He said, "I listen to your podcast on my drive home to Whitstable from Canterbury each Sunday evening. My route is determined by the length of that week's episode. Anything around 15 minutes allows for the direct route. Closer to 18 minutes requires a slow detour around the university campus with a view over the city and the cathedral. Should you ever plan longer episodes, I'd be delighted, but I may have to start getting the bus." I have very little idea of how long a podcast is going to take before I sit down and record it and edit it. If I don't stop now, I'm afraid that the listener of Whitstable, which is famous for its oysters, may find that he needs to walk home to listen to the podcast. 4 weeks ago, on Monday the 30th of June, we had at Mass the comic story of Abraham and his auction with God, when God says he'll destroy Sodom if he doesn't find 50 just men in the city, and Abraham starts by asking for a 10% discount and ends up knocking God all the way down to 10 just men. I said then that this reading would be quite a challenge in church because you had to let the humour come through without deliberately trying to be funny. Well, as it turns out, the rhythm of the Sunday readings brings this very same story to Mass this coming Sunday. And this Sunday, at Holy Redeemer and St. Thomas More, Chelsea, it is my turn to read. Wish me luck. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.